So for the season of Lent, we are going to be sampling from the book of Judges. Judges is not a book that shows up very often in our church preaching calendar, and it's a fairly long book. We're just going to be getting little bits and pieces from it. And there's lots of interesting and lots of problematic stuff in the book of Judges. And just one thing I want to point out before I jump into this sermon is that Judges tells the story of when the people left the wilderness where Moses and Joshua led them. They come into the promised land, but it's before the time of the kings when King David and all of them led. And when they came into the promised land, there were already people living there. Now, it was very common at this point in time that lots of little tribes of people would move around and they would fight each other to control the land. So that's actually a pretty normal story. But especially in an American context, where the taking of land has a very heavy backstory to it, that's something that when I'm reading through the book of Judges always kind of sticks out to me. And we've actually talked about that in worship here before. I've preached on it. So I have a sermon that addresses that really directly. And so I kind of wanted to acknowledge that that's something that's happening that here, like, we hear it a little bit differently in an American context than we might have been understood in an ancient tribal, like, everyone moving around society. If you're curious about that, I have several really good articles, and I'm happy to share that sermon with you as well. But I'm not going to get into that in great depth over the next 6 weeks, because I have other things with the book of Judges that I think are interesting to talk about. We're going to start at the beginning, actually in the second chapter, and our reading jumps just a little bit because there's big, lengthy stories in the middle of sort of the overall arc. So this morning we're going to start in Judges chapter 2 in the first verse. "Now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I brought you up out of Egypt, and I brought you into the land that I had promised to your ancestors. I said to you, I will never break my covenant with you. For your part, do not make a covenant with the people of the land. Tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my commandment. See what you have done. So now I say to you, I will not drive them out before you. They will become adversaries to you. Their gods will be a snare to you.' When the angel of the Lord had spoken these words to all the Israelites, the people lifted up their voices and wept. And they named that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. Now, a little while later, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the power of those around them who had plundered them. Yet the Israelites did not listen even to their judges, for they lusted after the gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the ways in which their ancestors walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord. The Lord was with their judge, and God delivered them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord would be moved to pity by the Israelites' groaning because of those who persecuted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they would relapse and behave worse than their ancestors, following other gods, worshiping them, and bowing down. They would not drop their practices or their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And God said, 'Because this people have transgressed my covenant that I commanded to their ancestors and have not obeyed my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died, in order to test Israel, because whether or not they would take care to walk in the way the Lord, the walk in the way of the Lord as their ancestors did. The Lord left these other nations, not driving them out, as had been handed over to Joshua. Now these are the nations that the Lord left to test all those in Israel who had no experience of any war in Canaan. It was only the successive generations of Israelites might know war, to teach them who had no experience before. The five lords of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, the Hivites who lived on Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon as far as Lebo Hamath. They were the teaching of testing of Israel, to know whether Israel would obey the commandments of the Lord, which God commanded their ancestors by Moses. And so the Israelites came to live among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So lately, John and I have been watching our way through the 1976 BBC miniseries I, Claudius, the one starring Derek Jacobi and Shan Phillips and Patrick Stewart back when he had a whole head of curly hair. And I am sort of guessing from the looks on your face that is not how you all expected me to open my sermon this morning. I mean, what are the kids into these days? 50-year-old British miniseries that they can find at the local library. Anyway, if you haven't seen it, I, Claudius, or if it's been 50 years since you saw it, I, Claudius is based on the 1930s book by the same name written by Robert Graves. And it tells a fictionalized account of the Julio-Claudian dynasty, the people who ruled the Roman Empire from about 50 years in BC, or before Christ, to, you know, 100 or so years after Christ, or CE, the sort of window of time. Now, the show looks like it was shot in someone's basement, and it looks like they hired Enoch and Moses to handle costuming and makeup for it. But if you put that aside, the actual writing and the acting on the show are amazing, and it really does sort of stand the test of time in that regard, even if the production is just garbage. The story itself is really engrossing, if not actual historical fact. Now, it's a great family drama. You get all these fantastic stories about, you know, oh, grandma is poisoning her grandson in order to make sure that her chosen heir becomes the next emperor of Rome. And aunts and uncles are always being sent off to desert islands as punishment for whatever crime against the emperor they happen to commit. But beyond that, one of the reasons I think the show is really compelling to me, and I suspect it was compelling when it was popular many years ago, is the backdrop of the story of the actual Roman Empire. These little, like, missives that come in from far afield, these questions of the control of the Germanic tribes or concern over Rome's influence on these outlying provinces, the, like, constant push and pull of what the boundaries of control of Rome actually are. And I think in general, this is one of the reasons that the story of the Roman Empire remains a sort of fascination, especially in American culture. Because the Roman Empire raises all these fascinating questions about political and economic power. Like, how does this political behemoth, the vast army that they had, the most powerful army in the Western world at that time, how did they go from controlling huge parts of Asia and Northern Africa and the whole of Europe to just total oblivion in a few generations' time? It's a fascinating question, and I suspect that we sort of are fascinated with that in part because this rise and fall of empires gives us the thought that if we could just understand what someone else did wrong, maybe we won't make quite the same mistake. And it's not just the Roman Empire. There's the Persians and the Greeks, and there's the British and the Belgian colonial experiments, and there's countless fictional empires that we all like to follow. But the question that we're really sort of asking, I think, at the center of a lot of those stories is what does it mean to be a part of a collective group of people in a political sense? We might call it a nation state today, but there's been lots of ways we've defined political groups of people over time. And how do these groups of people, how do nations or empires or tribes rise and how do they fall? Now, these are actually some of the central questions on a much smaller and more granular scale that we are going to hear throughout the book of Judges. Now, we're just going to be sampling from the book of Judges. If the entire book were like one of those 2-pound boxes of every single chocolate that Godiva makes, we're just going to be opening up that like cute little one that costs $20, but it only has 4 pieces of chocolate in it. That's what we're going to get for Lent this year. Sorry if you gave up chocolate for Lent. And Judges, as I mentioned earlier, is the story of this turbulent period of reinvention in the lives of the Hebrew people, as they go from being these 12 disparate little tribes who are leaving slavery in Egypt and being brought out into the promised land, into what we actually kind of think of when we imagine Israel as an ancient kingdom. Wow, what is happening out there? Okay. Yeah. Judges fills in the 300-year gap between being wandering tribes leaving slavery and going into the full kingship model, which we're far more familiar with in Israel. Now, to the best of our scholarly understanding, Judges was actually probably a collection of little disparate tales of warriors and leaders of those separate tribes that were brought together, and then over about 1,000 years, people edited them and rewrote them and shaped them to form this nice narrative arc that is the book today. But these are probably little stories that were all brought together about how these tribes became the Kingdom of Israel. Now, the best way to sort of imagine the book of Judges is like a descending spiral. So Judges is actually told in 12 cycles of this spiral. And it is an incredibly dark and violent and difficult book of the Bible to read. Honestly, I think it might be the most difficult book of the Bible to read, in my opinion. The Israelites go through this spiral cycle 12 times, and the cycle works like this. The Israelites are reminded by God, "We have a covenant. You are my people. I will take care of you, and all you need to do is follow the laws and ordinances that I gave to your ancestor Moses." And the people do not do that. The people do what is right in their own eyes. They do evil in the eyes of the Lord. And so God sends out to them other nations to attack these little fledgling tribes and, in a sense, punish them. And the people call out to God and they say, "Oh God, we are so sorry. We disobeyed your ways. We'll do better next time. Come and help us. We're getting attacked by the Canaanites or the Hittites or the Jebusites or whomever." And God says, "Yes, yes, you're right. I love you. I will send to you a judge." Now, this is judge in the sense of like magistrate or political leader or like a warrior tribal leader is how you can imagine it. And God sends them a judge, and while the judge is in place, the judge provides stability and leadership, and the people are taken care of, and they win some battles, and they feel stable. But then the judge dies, and then the people start doing what is right in their own eyes, and this time it's a little worse than it was last time. And the cycle begins again, and 12 times you rotate through this cycle. And instead of like learning their lesson and getting better, the tribes of Israel get worse and worse and worse. Their evil gets more profane and more violent. It's just like, it really is beyond what you could imagine in scripture if you haven't read through this book. And at the end of Judges, what we have is just this total dissolution of all social connections and all religious sort of commitments. You have a society that's in complete disarray. And the book ends on kind of that dark note. Now, I'm assuming that a lot of you have not read through Judges, and so I do want to say, I would invite you to read the bits that I'm not preaching on, but I do want to give a warning that the kind of violence that is depicted in the story of Judges is a very like person-to-person level violence, especially toward the end. There's a lot of violence toward children and female characters. It's a very hard story to read. There's whole swaths of Judges I won't be preaching, not because I don't think we should hear the stories, but quite frankly, I don't think they're appropriate to be read from the pulpit, when, especially when we have kids in the room. Judges is the only book of the Bible where I actually started crying when I read part of it, because it's just really dark. So if you do choose to read along and to get to know the depth of this story, I would invite you to also like let me know you're reading it. I would be happy to sit down and talk with you. There's wonderful scholarship available on this, and I'd be happy to have those conversations. But just a little like content warning on the book of Judges. Now, like I said, this is a cycle, it repeats, and you can imagine that this is just getting worse and worse. And there's this phrase that repeats throughout the book of Judges that says, "The people did what was right in their own eyes, and there was no king in Israel." And I think that is such an interesting refrain, and that's why I chose Judges to play around with during Lent and to sample from. Because I think that Judges, as difficult and dark as it is at times, can have in it moments that are a cautionary tale for our time or for what it means to live in a communal society with other people. Now, I am not terribly worried. I don't stay up at night asking questions about waning political prestige in the United States or our influence on the world stage. Like, those questions do not bother me. But I am concerned about what it means to live in a society where I look around and I see a disintegration of social safety nets. And I do worry about a loss of, like, a perceived social norm of kindness. I'm not sure that ever really existed in America. Like, I don't think women or people of color have ever expected that people were going to be kind and fair to them all the time. But that perceived loss of kindness really does weigh on me. The way that we do or don't care for the most vulnerable people in our own midst, those are questions that do concern me. And I think those are questions we are going to hear come up throughout the story of the judges. As a society disintegrates, what is lost? And how does God meet the people in the midst of that? Now, this is sort of the hard part of Judges, but there's this really beautiful little hopeful note that you can hold out for. And I want you to notice that God never actually disappears from the scene in the book of Judges. The people get terrible. The people get worse and worse and worse. And then when the people cry out and say, "Oh God, we need you," God shows up. Sometimes God is very angry. Sometimes God is very disappointed. Sometimes God says, "Well, you definitely got what was coming to you because you guys are terrible people." But the fact is that God always shows up. And God says, "Yes, I will bring you a judge. This judge will be a just ruler for you. And if they listen to me, you all will be taken care of." And then even at the end of the book, where it seems that all hope is lost, the society is completely disintegrated, what we know from the story of Scripture is that God said, "Okay, fine, the judges aren't working. You guys want a king? I will bring you a king." And then we enter into this whole other story of what it means to be the nation of Israel under the lineage of kings and queens for the next 1,000 years. But the hope is that God never actually disappears. God is still present. And in fact, there's this little, like, twist to the book of Judges that I love. It's not formally included in the book of Judges, but the very next book of the Bible is Ruth. Now, if you opened up Ruth, the very first line tells you, "In the time of the judges." And you know that this little odd 4-chapter book of the Bible actually could just be taken and slotted right into the middle of this dark, difficult story of the judges. The story of Ruth and Naomi and Boaz. And Boaz is this deeply hopeful character. Now, God never shows up in the book of Ruth. God does not appear once in there. But Boaz is sort of the representation of everything you might want in a society. Boaz cares for the most vulnerable in his midst. He provides food and margin for people to come along and glean his grain. Boaz is the one who meets at the city gate and follows the rules that are given to him for the just implementation of a society. Boaz is the one who marries the foreigner Ruth and repairs the community's relationship with Naomi and in his own way becomes the grandfather of the great King David, right? In the time of the judges, there was still hope. There were still good people who were maintaining a just community. And so I think our invitation for Lent is to listen closely to these stories, to be appalled at the moments where people have this incredible ability to wound and harm one another, both person to person, but also in ways that disintegrate and destroy whole communities and leave people incredibly vulnerable to the lack of care in their midst. But always there's this hope that God is present, that God continues to listen, and that God is far more faithful than the people could ever be. And that is sort of the gift of the story of the judges for us. That in the midst of the concerns and worries we might carry with us, God is present, and God will work with us when we call for the rebuilding of our own communities. Amen.